Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the World Affairs Council of Northern California, brought to you from the World Affairs Council offices in downtown San Francisco. I am Gloria Duffy, CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'll be your chair for today. We also welcome all of our radio listeners, both in San Francisco and around the nation. Now it is my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Today's speaker, I have to say, is my friend and also my former boss, and so it gives me particular pleasure to introduce him. He is one of the Bay Area's most distinguished and best-known residents. Most of you already know quite a bit about Bill Perry's background and history. He is a mathematician by training. He took his undergraduate degree from Stanford, then he returned home to Pennsylvania, where he took his doctorate at Penn State. He and Lee Perry, who had known each other since high school, I believe, made their way back to the Bay Area from Pennsylvania, where Bill worked in the early days of Silicon Valley industry and then founded ESL Corporation, which was a pioneer in electronic surveillance and intelligence technologies for defense purposes. Dr. Perry was appointed Director of Defense Research and Engineering, and spent the Carter administration at the Pentagon, where he supervised the development of smart weaponry and the stealth technologies that have now become so important to American defense. Returning again to Stanford in 1981, Bill was the much more distinguished resident of the center where I had my office, and over the years he has played a very important role in the development of one of the country's most important non-governmental research institutes on security affairs, the Center for International Security and Cooperation, first as a senior fellow, then as co-director, and now as chair of its executive committee. When he returned to California after the Carter administration, Dr. Perry was also a partner at Hambrecht & Quist, the investment banking firm, heading their technology practice in Silicon Valley. In 1993, President Clinton and Defense Secretary Les Aspin tapped Bill to be Deputy Secretary of Defense, and then in January of 1994, he became Secretary of Defense. As Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry brought his entrepreneurial bent to government. In his years at the Department of Defense, he led the way in the demilitarization of the former Soviet states, facilitated a new security treaty with Japan, took NATO through its transition to expansion, but also creating the Partnership for Peace as an interim measure, reformed defense procurement to buy from commercial sources, improved the quality of life for service people, and in every possible way brought his insight and inspiration to bear in this role. I recall when I met Bill to discuss coming to DOD myself, and he told me that the people already at the Defense Department are here to prevent bad things from happening. Your role will be to make good things happen. And this was his own motto during that time. Dr. Perry received the Presidential Medal of Freedom at the end of his tenure as Secretary of Defense. He returned to California thinking he would return to a quiet life of scholarship and investing in a few internet startups, but this was hardly the case. Since that time, he has published a book called Preventive Defense, and then President Clinton last year tapped Bill as special envoy to deal with the serious problems on the Korean Peninsula, the potential nuclearization of North Korea, the missile tests, border clashes, and humanitarian issues in that area. With his customary leadership, Dr. Perry has managed to resolve some of the thorniest problems in the North Korea-South Korea relationship and the relationship of North Korea with the U.S. But he's going to tell you about this himself, so it is my pleasure and honor to introduce Dr. William J. Perry.
Thank you very much, Gloria, for that wonderful introduction. It was about a year ago, the President asked me to take on the task of reviewing from first principles America's policy towards North Korea. I must tell you very candidly that this was an unwelcome request to take on what I knew would be a difficult and probably unrewarding task. As I thought about it, a stream of consciousness flashed me back to the major times in my life that I've been involved with Korea. first week of June 1950 was a big week in my life. That was the week that I got my master's degree from Stanford. I accepted my first full-time job, and I received a commission in the U.S. Army Reserves. My life, as I saw it, was all set. Exactly one week later, North Korea made a surprise invasion of South Korea, quickly captured Seoul, and were headed south. Even though Secretary of State Acheson had earlier not included Korea in America's security perimeter, President Truman did not hesitate, decided immediately that we must defend South Korea, and gave instructions to General MacArthur to do so. Now, you've probably have forgotten, but at that time, we had no troops in South Korea. We had an occupation army in Japan, but none in South Korea. So MacArthur confidently put together a task force and sent it over to South Korea with the objective of stopping the North Koreans. His task force was headed by a man named Smith. It became to be called Task Force Smith. They were poorly equipped, poorly trained, poorly motivated, and when they arrived in Korea, instead of stopping the North Koreans, they were essentially annihilated by the North Koreans, who continued to proceed south towards Busan. The United States then desperately started pulling together reinforcements to send over there, both from Japan, and they began loading troop transports on the west coast of the United States to make the roughly one-month journey to get to Korea. And it was a race as to whether our troops would get there before the rest of the South Korean army and the American troops that were sent there from Japan would be pushed off the peninsula. During this time, they began an extensive call-up of reserves. And so every day I went to the mailbox expecting to find a one-way ticket to Korea for them. As it happened, that call never came to me, but it came to tens of thousands of other reserves. We did get the reinforcements there in time. MacArthur made a brilliant end run of the North Korean troops with his landing at Incheon, essentially defeated the North Korean army and pushed them out of South Korea, into North Korea, all the way up almost to the Chinese border. And if that had been the end of it, we would not be standing here today discussing about security problems in Korea. But a funny thing happened on the way to the Chinese border, which was the Chinese troops made a surprise attack, pushed the American troops all the way back essentially to the border between North and South Korea, where we reached a stalemate. As a consequence, the Korean War did not end with a victory. It did not even end with peace. Instead, it ended with a truce, a dangerous armed truce, which exists to this day. Now, flash forward to September of 1977. The American forces had been out of Vietnam a few years, and our allies, Japan and Korea, were becoming increasingly worried about whether they could depend on the United States for their security. And that worry was aggravated by President Carter's suggesting that it might be time to pull our troops out of Korea. With that worry on their mind, South Korea had started covert research on a nuclear weapons program. This is South Korea I'm talking about, not North Korea. At the time, I was the Undersecretary of Defense, and I was sent to Seoul to South Korea two things. First of all, they could count on the United States for their security, and secondly, to knock off the nuclear weapons program, which they did. Now, flash forward to June of 94. North Korea, by then, had been for a decade pursuing their own nuclear program. In particular, they had a nuclear power facility at a location called Yongbyon. they were using a reactor that was particularly susceptible to proliferation. And by June of 1994, this reactor had unloaded its spent fuel, and the North Koreans were prepared to process it. If they had gone ahead with the processing, then they would have had the ability, they would have produced enough weapon-grade plutonium that they would have had the ability to make about 6 nuclear bombs. And if they'd continued indefinitely at that facility, it had the ability to make about 10 nuclear bombs a year thereafter. Now, at that time, the deterrence, as we saw it, was solid, even though the North Koreans had approximately 1 million men in their army, 2/3 of them based close to the border, therefore in a short warning attack posture. There were about half that many troops in South Korea and Americans facing them. But, of course, the United States also had highly ready reserves in Japan, Alaska, and Hawaii. And putting all that together, we believed that deterrence was solid, but that the introduction of nuclear weapons could upset that deterrence and therefore make the prospect of a war much more likely. Therefore, we concluded, the American government concluded, that the introduction of nuclear weapons posed an unacceptable risk to our security and set about with a number of actions, the first of which would have been imposing crippling sanctions on North Korea if they proceeded with the processing of this fuel. North Korea responded that they would consider the imposition of these sanctions an act of war, and they said that they would turn Seoul into a sea of flames. They have a remarkable capacity for invective, but the sea of flames really sort of captured the imagination. Many in the United States said, well, this is just rhetoric. But at the time I was a Secretary of Defense, I did not believe we could assume that. And therefore, I spent 2 solid days right after their announcement of the Sea of Flames reviewing our war contingency plans. And as a result of that, prepared plans for a major reinforcement of our troops in Korea, and at the same time made plans to evacuate civilians, American civilians, from South Korea. That is where we were in June of 94. During my period as the tenure as the secretary, it was the only time that we came close to what I thought would have been a major war, and we came very close to it at that time. That crisis, however, happily was resolved not with a war, but through diplomacy, and that diplomacy led to something called the agreed framework. The agreement in the agreed framework was that the North Koreans would freeze all activities at this Yongbyon facility and in time dismantle it. And the Americans and Koreans and South Koreans and Japanese would provide them in time with another reactor which would produce equivalent electricity but would not be so susceptible to proliferation. And in the interim period, we would provide them fuel oil that they could use to generate the electricity they would use by having shut down this reactor. Now, fast forward to September of 98, just a year ago. A new crisis developed. This crisis built up rather slowly with an acceleration of a missile program in North Korea that was culminating at that time in the deployment of medium-range missiles in North Korea that were capable of targeting not just South Korea, but all of Japan. And then at that time, the North Koreans made an attempt to launch a satellite. In our judgment, it was a failed attempt, but they used a long-range missile to launch that satellite into orbit. And this long-range missile flew over Japan and finally impacted in the Pacific Ocean. This caused great consternation, both in the United States and in Japan. And all the while this was going on, we were looking at intelligence reports which showed a large underground facility, huge cave, being built in North Korea at a place called Kumchang-ni. This underground facility was large enough to house the reactor and the processor that were at Yongbyon. And so this, coupled with the missile program, raised the fear in both the United States and in Japan that the North Koreans were preparing a nuclear weapon program to be launched by missiles. One of the reactions to this in the U.S. Congress and in the Japanese Diet was a move to scuttle the agreed framework. Now, of course, this would have had a perverse effect, the opposite effect of what was intended. Because we were concerned, and rightly concerned, about the missiles in North Korea, we were about to stop the agreed framework, which would have allowed the North Koreans to proceed with the nuclear weapons to put on those missiles. And it was at this perilous point that President Clinton called me to conduct the policy review. And considering my personal history with Korea and considering the danger of the situation, I knew that I could not refuse the request. And so I started out. We put together a team, a mixed team of government and non-government people. The non-government people were myself and Dr. Ash Carter from Harvard University, who had worked with me in the Defense Department and had been my co-author in the Preventive Defense book. The government team was headed by Ambassador Wendy Sherman from the State Department and included people who were truly expert in Korea, had spent their whole careers working and studying Korean problems. This team had full access to national security officials, the President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, National Security Advisor, and others, and full access to the Congress. During the course of the last year, I have literally had dozens of meetings at Congress and with the administration in the course of this study. In addition to that, we had many meetings with intelligence experts, with Korean experts, and with the relief organizations who were working in North Korea for several reasons. First of all, they provided, in some ways, the best firsthand account of what was going on in this reclusive country. And secondly, what they were doing, which is providing relief for the desperate economic situation, in particular the famine that was going on in North Korea, was itself closely related to the study we were conducting. One of the relief agencies I met with, by the way, was a local group, the Nautilus, which is located in Berkeley, which is, I would tell you, is doing the work of the Lord in what they are doing to provide relief to the suffering people in North Korea. We also formed a tripartite team with our allies, and I cannot overestimate how important that was. We started off this policy with the United States, Japan, and South Korea each having a different view about this problem, what was important about it, what was not important about it, what ought to be done about it. And yet, the first meeting I had with the president, I told him nothing can be done in formulating a policy in North Korea that does not have the full support and understanding of South Korea, and as it turns out, of Japan as well. Therefore, it was exceedingly important to get our three governments together on this. We have succeeded in doing that. And the policy report, which I submitted to the president, has the full concurrence and support of President Kim Dae-jung and Prime Minister Obuchi. Another remarkable development is that up until the time of this study, all of our relations on any issue whatsoever with Japan were bilateral and with South Korea were bilateral. And in the course of this study, we formed a trilateral meetings. seems like a simple and obvious thing to do, to bring the three governments together to discuss these issues, but it had not been done before. In the last 8 or 9 months, we have had 6 such trilateral meetings, with another one scheduled just a few weeks from now. And finally, we consulted with and got some support from the People's Republic of China, about which I'll be happy to say more during the question period. The conclusions of the study were that, first of all, is the deterrence is alive and well, that the military, put it in military language, the military correlation of forces on the Korean Peninsula strongly favors the Allies. And indeed, it's more strongly favors them today than it did during the June of 94 crisis. That's the good news. But, and this is a very important but, that whole deterrence posture could be upset by the introduction of nuclear weapons. The second conclusion was that there has been no fissile material produced at Yongbyon since the agreed framework went into place. But, and this is again an important but, that facility is still standing. It has not been dismantled yet. It's not due to be dismantled until the new reactor is installed. And therefore, any time the agreed framework would be aborted, the North Koreans could restart production of fissile material there in a matter of weeks. Therefore, the strategy based on the agreed framework, while it has been successful, will not be sustainable in the face of the missile firings, because if these missiles are continued to be fired, then the political support for the agreed framework dissolves, and if the political support for that dissolves, we're right back to where we were in the crisis of 94. A final conclusion is a very important one, because it drives our recommendations, our recommended actions, and it's different from the conventional wisdom. Let me share it with you. Basically, it is that the North Korea regime is not about to collapse. It is not about to collapse. Why do I say that? And why is it an issue even? It's an issue because, as I hinted earlier in my talk, the economy in North Korea has collapsed. Their industrial production, most of their industrial plants are down to 10 or 20% of productive capacity right now. They have almost no fuel in the country. They have almost no fertilizer for their farms. The agricultural output is at disastrous levels, has been for the last 5 years. Let me put that in perspective. The experts who have studied North Korea estimate that it takes about 5 million tons of grain a year for adequate subsistence. That 4 million, below 4 million, they are at the starvation and famine level. For the last 5 years, the production of grain has been between 3 and 3.5 million tons a year. And as a consequence, they have been at the famine level. And during that period of time, relief agencies who have worked there in the hospitals, the schools, and the day centers estimate that there have been several hundred thousand people die in the famine there, mostly children and older people. That famine has been largely alleviated in the last 2 years, not by any increase in production of grain, but by China and the United States providing grain to North Korea, about 500,000 tons from the United States, and we estimate about the same amount from China, which takes them just over the famine level, but not very much over. Now, in the face of this disastrous situation, which the North Koreans say was because of bad luck, weather, floods, drought, or because of the sanctions imposed by the United States, which I think have little or nothing to do with their economic situation. My own judgment, the judgment of most experts on the subject, is that this is a systemic failure of the government and the economic system in North Korea, and is likely to continue for a long time to come. So we have concluded then that the economy has collapsed, and therefore many experts concluded the collapse of the regime would certainly follow that. Our judgment is the regime will not collapse, that this is a police state in which the control is absolute, in which the access to information about the outside world is almost non-existent. I discussed this issue with some of my Russian colleagues who just looked at me in a strange way. What is the issue? What is the question? Can you learn nothing from history? He said, look at Ukraine in 1937 and 1938, where hundreds of thousands of people were dying of starvation a year. And every time another 100,000 people would starve, Stalin's grip on the country would get tighter. So my conclusion then was that this regime is not about to collapse. We must deal with them as they are, not as we would wish them to be. Not as we would wish them to be. Based on that judgment, our recommendation then to the president posed him with two alternatives. We said, if North Korea will agree to forego their missile program as well as the nuclear program, voluntarily forego it, then we should be prepared to move step by step in a reciprocal way towards a full normalization of relations, political, economic, diplomatic relations, just as we have done a few years ago with Vietnam. If, on the other hand, North Korea does not demonstrate by its actions, not by its words, but by its actions, that it is willing to remove that threat, then we must take actions to contain the threat. Now, I know perhaps better than anyone in this room what those actions would involve. And I know that they are risky and they're costly. And therefore, I greatly prefer the first alternative. But I had no way of knowing whether the North Koreans would be willing to participate in the first alternative. It was not something we could unilaterally impose on them. And so with that in mind, I scheduled a visit to Pyongyang, made this visit 4 or 5 months ago. I was received with great courtesy on that visit. We never knew when we went in there how we might be received. But the first clue that we're going to be received well was they gave us permission to fly our military airplane directly into Pyongyang, which is a very good sign and virtually unprecedented. I must say that when we landed, as we flew over North Korea, I was looking out the window and wondering if the air defense crews on the ground had gotten the word. But they apparently had. We landed without event, caused a great stir at the airport. This isn't exactly SFO in terms of busyness. We were probably the only airplane that landed that day. But we caused a huge stir with this a plane with U.S. of A on it and an American flag on the back landing at the Pyongyang airport. The discussions, which lasted for 4 days, were serious and constructive. Again, we didn't know what to expect because the North Koreans are famous for polemics in their discussion. No polemics, zero. It was all very serious and all very much to cases. In the course of this visit, we achieved some of what we wanted to, but by no means all. We were able to nail down a continuation of the nuclear restraint, both in their words and by their willingness to let a team of experts visit this big underground cave, a place I called Kumchongni. And our experts were able to confirm that this was not suitable for the installation of a reactor and processors. That greatly relieved our concern on that point. We posed to the North Koreans the two alternatives. Which would you like? Take your choice. It was obvious that they preferred the first alternative, but it was also obvious they were deeply conflicted on that. Indeed, I talked not only with the diplomats in North Korea, but I also talked with the military leaders. And the military leaders were very reluctant to give up their missiles. And that was part of the condition. Indeed, talking with the senior general in North Korea, who started off the meeting by making it clear to me that he had not wanted this meeting. He had been directed to come to the meeting. He said, this is the first time a senior general in the North Korean Military Commission has ever met with an official from a hostile power. And the meeting sort of went downhill from that point. And he was very clear that they did not want to give up their missiles, and as he saw it, for security reasons. And he put it to me in terse language, but language which I think I understood. He said, we are not going to be another Yugoslavia. And by that, he meant, if you attack us, we won't have a way of striking back, a way that can strike back all the way to the United States. And in his way of thinking, this provided a deterrence to the United States for actions which he thought we might be preparing to take. In short, when we left Pyongyang, it was clear that they were interested in this alternative, but were not prepared to make a decision on it. But they said they wanted to continue the discussion. So we've had three meetings since then, one in Beijing, one in Geneva, and one in Berlin, conducted by Ambassador Cartman for our side. The first two meetings were completely inconclusive. The last meeting in Berlin, we made a small step forward, first positive step, actually. It was not a big deal, but it was important. It was that the United States said, we will unilaterally ease some of the sanctions, in particular the sanctions which prohibit the sale of consumer products. And the North Koreans, in turn, agreed that they would suspend the test firing of future long-range missiles while these discussions were underway. To put that in context, they had, while we were discussing, on the pad, essentially, a longer-range missile than they had fired over Japan, one which had a range sufficient to reach the United States. And I pointed out to them that they fired that when probably my ability to deliver on any kind of an agreement with them would go out the window. So they agreed then to suspend that missile test. And my position was that those two actions were not the agreement. Those two actions simply created the environment or the atmosphere in which talks could begin. We expect those talks to begin in a few months and can hope for the best on them. As of today, my report is finished. I've briefed the President, the Congress, and the allies. And a senior North Korean official is planning a follow-on visit to Washington to start off those talks. I will participate in that first visit, and then I plan to hand in my spurs. The bottom line of all of this is I have told the President that I am confident that he should pursue those talks with the North Koreans seriously and creatively, but that I am not confident that this process will actually lead to a peaceful peninsula. Therefore, the United States should keep its powder dry. In particular, we should make no reductions in military readiness during the course of the talks. But having given that caveat, I have to say, share with you the same thing I shared with the President, that I'm hopeful that these talks, in fact, will lead to normalization and will create an environment that, after decades of war and threats of war, will finally allow the Korean Peninsula to be stable, prosperous, and secure. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. William Perry, former Secretary of Defense and Special Envoy with regard to North Korea. Now, please welcome Jane Wales, the President of the World Affairs Council, who will conduct the question and answer period.
Thank you to Gloria Duffy, CEO of the Commonwealth Club. It is a rare pleasure for me to be up here with two, not one, but two former colleagues and friends, so this is a special pleasure for me. We have a great number of questions, so we're going to have to move swiftly through them. The first two can be lumped together. Can China play a constructive role in engaging North Korea? And how does China fit into the North Korea, South Korea, Japan, U.S. picture?
The answer to the first question is yes. During the course of the study, I visited China and I met with President Jiang Zemin, the defense minister and the foreign minister, to discuss our concern with what was going on in North Korea. I told them that I thought their role could be pivotal, could be constructive. But I was not asking them to do a favor for the United States. I was asking them to consider their own security interest. And in the course of the dialogue, three things became clear. First of all, they do not want a war on the Korean Peninsula for their own interest and have nothing to do with our interest. Secondly, they would like to see a nuclear peninsula which is free of nuclear weapons and long-range missiles. And third, they do not want an arms race started in the region. Those are their three objectives, which coincide with our three objectives. And therefore, we had some basis for mutuality of interest on this problem, even if not on many other issues and problems. They are not, however, willing to act on those interests in public concordance with the United States. They do not want to be seen as ganging up with the United States against North Korea. The specific request I made of them was that they make a strong representation to North Korea to knock off the missile testing, because it might set off a chain of events over which neither we nor they would have control, which would lead to exactly the outcome that none of us desired. They have, in fact, done that. Whether or not that is effective, I don't know, but I do know that they have taken that action. In the long term, it is very important that we have China and ourselves pursuing the same objective relative to Korea, even though, as I said, we differ on many other issues.
Japan has new concerns following the firing of a missile over Japan. What has been Japan's reaction, and how has this incident changed our overall strategy and Japan's overall strategy for the region?
Japan's first reaction to the missile firing, as I said, was to question whether they should continue the support of the agreed framework. And the Japanese government is clear in their thinking that terminating the agreed framework would be counterproductive from their point of view because, as I indicated, it would simply give the North Koreans the ability to put nuclear weapons on those missiles and make them really dangerous. So the government believes they should continue that agreed framework even if the missiles are fired, but they say they may not have the political clout to make that happen because of the domestic political concern aroused in Japan. I might say the United States administration may find itself in the same position with its Congress. And therefore, it was very important to get the missile test firing stopped, and that was the immediate objective of our discussions with North Korea. Japan's interest in the region, security in the region, I think is also best stated by their recent reaffirmation of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty and by their, just a few months ago, passing in their Diet the approval for what's called the Revised Security Guidelines. I won't bore you with the details of the security guidelines, but the essence of it is that it provides the conditions by which Japan could support the United States military involvement, military forces, if they got involved in military conflict on the Korean Peninsula. Up until the time they revised those security guidelines, there was no real basis in Japanese law for doing that. And the revised security guidelines now make that possible. That's very important because it is an important factor to the deterrence posture that we have to maintain, and that deterrence is important for maintaining the security and stability on the peninsula.
What do you see as prospects for congressional support of your recommendations with regard to North Korea?
I think there will be a fair amount of rhetoric denouncing North Korea and the actions taken by North Korea and suggesting that we ought not to engage with them, we ought not to coddle dictators, was the term used in the congressional hearing. And I think when all that rhetoric is settled down and they look at the alternatives that are available to us, they will consider that the alternative of trying to move forward towards normal relations is better than the alternative of being in a continued state of war. So I think the Congress will reluctantly be with us on this, but I cannot be 100% sure of that. What I'm not sure of, as I think in my talk, is the North Koreans will be with us on this. It takes not only the Congress, but it takes the North Koreans as well. And that's only time will tell whether we will have them with us.
What is the cave in North Korea for?
I don't know.
What conditions must exist in order for the United States to withdraw its ground forces from the border of South and North Korea?
That's so far in the future and involves so many other things happening that I can hardly focus my thinking on that question. It is not something that is in the prospect in the immediate future. What would have to fundamentally evolve is a peace on the Korean Peninsula, probably a unification on the peninsula. I don't see any of those happening anytime in the foreseeable future, so I really haven't focused much of my thinking on that. In the meantime, as I said, I think it's very important not to send the wrong message by pulling those forces out of there.
What are the legitimate defense needs of North Korea, and can they be met without nuclear-armed missiles?
The North Korea sees, if I were a North Korean general and looking at military threats, I would say the threat I would be worried about is that South Korea might try to forcibly use their military forces to force a unification on their terms. Now, I can tell you that is a possibility that is so remote it's not even worth thinking about, but I can understand how North Koreans might believe that is a possibility. In any event, their plans are organized around defeating that move were it to happen. And were it to happen, they would see that the American forces would be in conjunction with the South Koreans. At an earlier stage in their history, they were quite clear and quite explicit that the purpose of their military forces was for them, they themselves, to reunify Korea by military force. And they have never really renounced the ability to do that. They have conceded they don't have the capability of doing it, but they have not renounced the desire of doing it. So either from an offensive or defensive point of view, it has to do with the unification of Korea by force.
This is a question that sounds like some that you got from Congress. North Korea seems to have perfected the practice of diplomatic blackmail by threatening potentially violent policies and then getting rewarded for calling them off. Do you see this behavior as changing or being changed by our own actions?
I don't accept the premise, but the answer to the question is no, I don't see what we're doing as fundamentally changing the political strategy or inclination of the North Korean government. I believe that the North Koreans are pursuing their missile program for the reasons explained to me by the general, which is they see it important for their own security. And for that reason, they will be reluctant to give up that missile program. And I'm not at all sure that the proposal we made to them will persuade them that they should get up. By the way, what we're proposing to them is not simply stop the test of the missiles. We are proposing that they comply with what's known as the missile technology control regime. And if they do that, that means they will not be able to produce, deploy, or export any missiles of ranges greater than 300 kilometers. That is a huge change from where they are now, and it's a very substantial restriction. It's something they would have to voluntarily agree to do, just as many other countries in the world have voluntarily accepted the missile technology control regime. But that's what the proposition is, and that's what we are hoping that they will do. But in terms of changes of their political actions, I think the only hope that those are going to change is if indeed we move towards a normalization of relations, and it is clear in such a way that it is clear that they will have renounced the forceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula, and they will have seen by this normalization relation that there is no threat to the South Korea and the United States trying to forcefully reunify the peninsula.
To what degree does the North rely on weapons sales to finance its regime?
One of the real security issues caused by this missile program is not just the threat to Japan and the United States, but they export these missiles primarily to countries in the Middle East and South Asia. And therefore, they aggravate regional security issues in those parts of the world. They have, this is one of their largest and probably the only important source of hard currency into the country, since they don't make anything else that anybody seems to be interested in buying. So, but it by no means finances their regime. It's perhaps a few hundred million dollars a year, which, if they're lucky, will pay for the missile program, but won't pay for much else.
This next question takes you beyond North Korea. Do you favor a nuclear test ban at this time?
Yes.
Back to Korea. How sophisticated are our means for verifying the status of North Korea's nuclear missile program?
We have very sophisticated means for verifying compliance with an agreement on long-range missiles. In particular, I have complete confidence that we would determine every test firing of the missiles that he made. They have not yet test fired the missile which would have a range sufficient to reach the United States. And were they to do that, with or without an agreement, we would certainly know about it. We have equal ability, I think, to determine whether they are embarked on a program to produce fissile material for nuclear weapons. We have little or no ability to determine whether they are doing the physics of nuclear weapons, which can be done inside a laboratory. It's very difficult to try to verify that. And we have very little ability to verify what they might be doing in the way of development of missiles, which, again, can be done within a laboratory. It's hard to verify.
What is the United States, as the largest donor of food aid to North Korea, doing to pressure the government to allow for better monitoring of aid distribution?
We are one of the largest monitors, suppliers of food, as I indicated, about 500,000 tons of grain a year. We do not supply that directly. We supply it to the World Food Program, which is administered by the United Nations. And they are the ones that are monitoring the distribution and compliance program. They and the individual NGOs or relief agencies that are providing it. We are supportive of that, but it's not the responsibility of the United States government to do that monitoring. I have talked literally with dozens of the people who are there in relief programs and get a mixed report about compliance. Generally, they are confident of the delivery of the food up to the county level. And then the relief agencies who are actually in the hospitals and the daycare centers see the food being delivered there. So they feel relatively comfortable that the bulk of this food is getting to the targets that is intended for the young people and the sick people and the older people who otherwise might not be able to provide for themselves. But it is it's a leaky system. The verification is not really done well and systematically, and I would not want to suggest to you that it is. I think the most important point relative to the assessment provided to me by the people in the relief agencies is they report that they have been able to see the difference in the schools and the daycare centers, just in the state and the health of the children who are there, who have gone from being in a desperate situation a few years ago to being not comfortable today, but at least reasonably healthy today. This you can observe just by looking. I mean, more than half of the children which they saw at the schools and the daycare centers over the last 5 years, you could tell physically were malnourished. That is, they were 60 or 70% of the weight they should be for their age. So, and they see definite improvements in physical appearance over the last few years. And it seems to me that's a much better indicator than all of the elaborate verification systems that might be set up.
North Korea is perhaps the most isolated country in the world, with sanctions in place for 50 years. Does it care? At times it seems irrational.
It is the most isolated country in the world today. They have almost totally isolated the people from what's going on in the outside world. And except for a relatively few fraction of 1% of elite who travel or have access to international papers, most of the people haven't the faintest idea what's going on in the rest of the world. What they know is what they have been taught from the age of 2 on, which is a propaganda machine of dimensions which are hard for us to understand or to grasp. I will say from most my own experience in talking with North Koreans that most of them either believe or seem to believe the propaganda that they've heard, not surprising since they have not had access to any alternative sources of information. I might also say that one of the main reasons that I am not more optimistic about this proposal that I may be accepted by the North Koreans is that they do not see it as an unalloyed benefit, that to get the full benefit of this normalization of relations and to get some of the economic benefits of normal trade and normal business dealings that will be entered into their country, businessmen and government officials from the United States, from South Korea, from Japan, and this will break that absolute control that they have over the people and the information that the people can have. And I think the regime there has every reason to be concerned that that will greatly weaken their hold on power. One of my colleagues, when we put this proposal together, said that seems to you, speaking to Americans, like it's all a benefit, but it's going to seem to the North Koreans like an exploding cigar, which is a nice gift you offer somebody and he starts smoking it and blows up in his face. But they are very much concerned with any proposal which would have large numbers of non-North Koreans in their country because of the danger it would have in weakening their control of information that goes to the people.
The two final questions. One is, did our intelligence agencies foresee the existence of long-range missile technology? And secondly, was the late discovery that they were extracting plutonium a sign of the success or failure of the nuclear nonproliferation regime?
I think the nonproliferation regime, I think this is a success story, the nonproliferation regime, because we have counted on it and the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, I guess that stands for actually enforcing some of the controls on these nuclear reactors. And to this day, they are at Yongbyon assuring compliance with the agreements that have been made. Did the intelligence agencies foresee the long-range missile? Yes, they were forecasting and given quite a few details about this missile development program for a good many years. I think they were surprised that the North Koreans leaped to this stage of long-range missiles as quickly as they did. And without going into details on this, the missile, which they call the Nodong, has been deployed, has been tested many years ago and has been deployed for the last year or so. And so it is a proven missile, at least North Koreans regard it as a proven missile. The long-range missiles simply use it as the first stage and then add second or third stages to it. For a long time, our intelligence community has been predicting they would use this missile and put a second stage on it. But the firing that took place over Japan also put a third stage on it, and that was a surprise. And that gives it an ability to go to longer range than they had been forecasting.
Our thanks to former Secretary of Defense William J. Perry for addressing us today and for his role as Special Assistant to the President and Secretary of State for U.S. North Korean Policy Review. We also want to thank our audience here in San Francisco and across the country for listening on the radio. And now the meeting of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.